go back and ask him about that. He mentioned shifts. I want to go back and ask about that. So that if you've got a recording or if you've got an interview situation, that you come out of it with as complete a discussion of each of those topics as possible, so that you don't get just small pieces scattered all over. Any thoughts on this?
Could you elaborate a bit on the very first one in the context of the interviewing elders, where the attitude is, we are going to ask the elders questions that they know something about and that we know nothing about, or very little. So how does know your subject matter?
Well, I would maintain that it's very difficult to ask elders questions unless you know enough to know what the right questions are. Now, perhaps you can get assistance from other elders who can act as intermediaries in asking, you know, to them to describe certain things. But the more, let me put it this way, the more you know about the subject, the more you'll be able to converse with somebody about the subject, and the more interested they may be in giving you information about it. You know, if I've had some experiences out on the sea ice, I'm in a much better position to ask questions about sea ice, historic sea ice use. I'm not exactly sure how you get around that question, if in fact you do get around it. But I think it's a good one.
How about if you ask the relatives of the elders, like mother or daughter? I mean, you could get the first information and go on to the second, you know, ask them where were they born and how long did they live in one place? You know, there's a beginning conversation.
No, I raised the same point in a recent meeting, and the reaction seemed to be, and Bob, correct me if I'm wrong, was that when you ask an elder a question, they tend to respond by telling you a story often. So it doesn't lend itself to asking a question and then eliciting more responses, but that they just tell you.
Does the story contain the answer?
If you know the story, or if you know what they're trying to mean. Like, it's like a parable. The example is that a lot of people, you know, answer in that manner. A lot of elder people, you know, it's like, and what they do is they, excuse me, they expect you to know or have some kind of knowledge of whatever you're asking questions about in that manner. And they start, then they'll answer you a little bit, like I said earlier, to a certain extent, and maybe tell a story.
That's an important dynamic then for us to think about. And and design around that.
I've heard other people say that oftentimes the elders assume that young people know more than they do, and so that you get answers that aren't complete because they just presuppose that you have basic knowledge that you might not have about almost any kind of technical thing.
Then it's important to go to the intermediary person who can answer what the older person might consider to be a silly question, but which may be key to understanding the more complicated or the more parable.
I think one of the things too is that I know when I was learning how to hunt, the technique that my dad learned, taught me, was almost the same way that he probably was taught, and you know, generation after generation before that was learn how to hunt, was that first thing you do is you just follow. You watch everything, you know. Then later on, little by little, then you begin to start getting involved in it more and more. And me and my dad used to be gone for weeks. We sit there and we just talk, you know, when we have to talk, you know, he said, give me this or do that, or you think we should do this and that. Other than that, you know, there was total silence. And he never did actually step me down and say, here, this is the way you hold a rifle, this is the way you shoot. And you know, just like you know how some people teach somebody or try to do teach them things is that you show them the whole thing. And you know, just like, and I was talking with other people is that the only ones that they have any sort of physical contact is their uncles. But every time I met my uncle out there, he would have a box of 50 rounds and he'd take me off to the side and he'd get a can real close and say, shoot it. You know, and he'd sit there and he'd watch you, and you said, oh, well, this arm is not up here and you're moving too much, you're not breathing right and stuff like that. He's the one that's telling you. And all the time your dad was assumed that you were watching him and you had picked up all those other little stuff.
Do you think that other people's uncles,
pardon?
Do you think that other people's uncles acted in a similar way?
Yeah, there's a lot of the people that I talk with, you know, being that I did that. And what I do a lot of times, I do the same thing. I take my son hunting and I just almost follow it without realizing it. And a lot of times what I do is I really think about it and I see my brother teaching my son how to shoot.
Hmm.
So I think, you know, like once you start getting into that, to certain, the way you learn, you see, you sort of go on and teach your kids the way in that manner too.
Well, I think that's an interesting point.
Yeah, most families, the closeness of the family, Bob had mentioned earlier, they start checking on your past from where you come from. Because if somebody goofs up, that means that whole family screwed up, you know. That's the story you remember. But if one little part of the family here makes sure, pretty soon everybody's watching out for everybody.
Let's return. That's important information in terms of how, as a group of people, you learn. And somehow, if that's a valuable principle and it still continues to be used, that maybe there's a way to integrate that into the school situation. Or maybe there's a way to integrate it into getting information that you need to fill out the historical record. Let's return to your question, though. How can you gather information from elders that is going to be as complete as you want when you may not have the subject matter background yourself? Tom, how are you going to handle that one?
Well, hopefully, if you ask something, then you get all that they could offer.
Mm-hmm.
And without insulting them by saying, would you mind or something if I checked over here? Because it just reminded me of my little son riding down the road. He says, why are all the trees, branches falling down? And I said, because all the snow is on top and it gets heavy and it falls and breaks.
Mm.
And he turns around and he says, is that right, Cam?
Mm.
You know, like, shit, man, don't care. And I didn't want to insult an elder right there, like, turning to this person,
right.
Like, fuck, man, why ask me if you don't believe me?
Yeah.
You know?
You know, some things, you can ask things without verbally asking. I mean, you...
If you can go back to the person, I think that's a helpful thing, is to go through, get a kind of a finite amount of information that you can digest, go back, go over it, figure out what you don't understand or where you need clarification, and then I think rather than sitting and hounding somebody during your one session, if you go back and say, what we were talking about before, refer to it, indicate that you really learned a lot and enjoyed it, and that you wanted to know more about things that you don't understand, with a respectful attitude, they'll probably be willing to fill in some of the gaps. Sometimes you have to get away from it for a while or, you know, go over the material before you exactly know what it is that you don't understand.
Yeah, that's it exactly. You need distance from the material at times. You need to get away, you need to listen to it, you need to think about it. You know, and that's an Anupiya value, is thinking about something someone said and kind of mulling it over in your mind and then coming back and in a similar situation asking the question again, or observing how someone responds in the situation.
Or if you had to ask the question again, I've seen instances where somebody said, Eddie, I'm so dumb, I'm so slow, can you do that to tell me again,
yeah,
show me again? And then you put them up higher and lower yourself, and then they feel good and you're getting what you really want.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when I say knowledge of the subject matter, that has to be a relative thing. I'm sitting here talking about things that I don't have a complete knowledge of. When I go out to do field work, when I'm going out interviewing people on subjects, I don't have a complete knowledge, but the more I know, the more I'm able to really converse with them and learn from them. That's just a principle that I think bears out and is worth keeping in mind.
Like in Judy's case, it'd be a lot better if you took a translator, because older people would feel more comfortable, you know, if they spoke and maybe back.
Well, what I'm kind of discovering is even among the any class people, like even on the staff, the extent to which they would get something even out of the case depends on how much of their own culture they are employed. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
I guess what occurs to me is that we're trying to distill what we get on the tapes to children in these schools who are probably even more remote from their own culture. And so getting back to what Pam's point was a few minutes ago about the assumption that those people may know more than they do, makes it all the more critical to be real sensitive to interpreting the information we did get to a little understandable frame.
Something that Bob mentioned earlier sort of made me think a lot of it maybe is your selection of what you get on the tape in the first place. There's some information that you want to learn how to make a snowshoe or something like that or anything. It makes a lot more sense to make a videotape of somebody doing it and then go back and ask them, why did you do this, why did you do that, or whatever, rather than to try to get them to describe it. Because certain, you know, I think language is used differently. In the traditional culture, language is used differently than English is used. We talk about everything and verbalize everything. And I think in UPAC, the traditional way, from what I understand, it was much more of this hands-on, watching somebody else do it, learning as you go along, and not just having somebody sit there and say, if you want to go out and hunt caribou, here's what you do, step one, you know, step 1A. Just not the, you know, it wasn't the way teaching occurred so much. And so some part of it might be the use of, you know, if you're going to get people to do stuff on tape, you want to choose stuff that lends itself to that kind of, you know, like getting the stories, the parables that have a moral, things that would have been taught in the language, and then the stuff that's hands-on, you just have to get somebody to do it for you.
Not only that, I think, I know a lot of you probably have some experience on trying to talk to some local Inupiaq people. You know, it's like, boy, sometimes I have a hard time sitting there having a conversation, you know, and especially the older people. They don't have to sit there and talk for 1 hour to try to explain to you something. They'll tell you what it is and just shut up.
One sentence. That's everything you need to know as far as they're concerned.
I think it's important for me to mark that down, for you to keep in mind. Certain things will lend itself to recording and some things won't. Or certain things will lend itself to the interview context, some things won't. There's nothing wrong with someone saying it all in a sentence. need to realize that. And we need to realize our limitations in the communicative process with that person and understand how the cultural processes work. We may not get the next edition till 2 or 3 days down the line. You know, it's a bit like the cereal. But we must keep our antennas out so that when that next message comes, we can integrate it with a formal one, which means we've got to keep some sort of a record. So there is a difference between snowshoe making and collecting a life history of someone like Manilok, isn't there?
Yeah, Manilok, you can go back to the record.
To what?
I said you can go back to get the record, right?
So,
oh, are you talking about Manilok,
yeah,
the man?
Yes.
Okay. Explain yourself. Because
yeah,
when we referred Manilok, we got a Manilok almost over there. That you're talking about. So.
The man.
There's another thing that I'd sort of like to raise, and this is something, maybe a situation that I put Tom in inadvertently, or just because I'm ambitious in what I want to accomplish. I think oftentimes the better work is a result of someone picking a few people to work with and really going back over time, you know, over a long period of time to those people and delving into the very deepest knowledge that they have of tradition, rather than what I've asked you to do, which is, you know, talk to everybody in Northwest Alaska, you know, and I guess we're going to have to deal with that eventually, because as you get more interested in what you're doing, you're not going to want to start going off to some new person and having to break the ice and go through it all over again. You know, you're going to probably find eventually two or three people that you really want to spend time with and get some real interesting knowledge of, especially when you get into those biography projects. But I think, you know, probably some of what we've done with the elders has been just to try to get, because there was this pressure of time, to get as much stuff down from as many people, just, you know, miles and miles of tape, without being able to go back and analyze it and work with, you know, Charlie Jensen, just sit down with Charlie Jensen for 2 years. And, you know, I'm sure he's got at least that much, if not more, than he could give. And that's, I guess that's a question, another priority that you've got to sort out.
Yeah.
If you're doing something like the life history of Manilok, then you would have to do something more along the lines of what they did down in Anchorage, which is to get several different people's recollections for comparative purposes of what they had heard about him.
You mean because he's no longer living?
Because he's no longer living, and because that you focused on a subject. You're not trying to find out everything that one individual person knows about Manilok. You're trying to find out what, you know, as much as you can about him from as many different sources. So the purpose of your research should determine a little bit how you go about it.
And, you know, there again, it shows you an example of how other people view him and how they thought about him. And, you know, it's like,
yeah, what
maybe that,
was,
you know, just, yeah, you know, one person had opinion about him, then the other one had a different type of opinion, and went on, and then it was 3-4 different people were, a lot of times they were looking at him, or some have seen him, and they said, well, they assume that he was, the reason he had certain things on him was because maybe of that. And some other people say, well, he had that because it was so and so. And, you know, they have different people having different opinions about that one man. In general, you know, it's like the basic thing that the knowledge that they know about him, that he was powerful and he, no, Angatko can penetrate his whatever power he had. They know that part, but a lot of them comment in there was that what he carried with him, or the way he acted, you know, he was out from the other people, and so other people couldn't really actually figure out who he was or what he was because of that.
Was he lonely?
Was he lonely, Manila? He was, you know, he didn't associate with people that much because of the fact, I think people were afraid of him for one thing. Another thing is that, being that he was so, he had a spiritual, some kind of type of power within him. and maybe they resent them. I don't know. You know, you can go on and on like that again.
And getting those different interpretations on the same subject to the same man is what makes it interesting. Not being afraid, not looking for the one interpretation. Not being afraid of different interpretations. Really what makes oral history so exciting.
And that would be sort of in opposition to a situation where you want to get some very old technical knowledge that there may only be one or two living people who have, and what you want to do is just get all that stuff while you can still get it. And so you want to work intensively with the person who's the only surviving person that can remember how there was a group caribou, you know, or something. The manufacture of an implement that's no longer made, how it was used.
I made a list of, a couple months ago, of the things I thought oral history was good at and the things I thought it was bad at. Maybe I'll just run through that list, and each of you have your ears peaked to be critical of this, thinking about your own situation, and then we'll take a break before 11. I think it's checks have come in. How can I compete with checks?
Can compete with letters.
I think that oral history is good at getting personal feelings. I think it's good at getting personal background on a person's life. I think it's good on first-hand accounts. Sometimes how to do it type things.
Are these the good ones or bad ones?
These are the good ones. I think it's good at determining local dynamics. What was meant by sharing in the past. How are stories told? Local dynamics. I think it's real good on genealogies. You know, what was your grandma's name? What was your grandpa's name? Which reminds me of the story of the priest who was searching through the archives in Fairbanks, looking for genealogical information to people in Nome. And I said, oh, why don't you call Nome? Speak to somebody in Nome. He said, I'm from Nome. Well, what are you doing here asking about genealogical information? I guess he didn't want to get into it with people there. But if you're really interested in genealogies, you got to go to the people who are related, because we all know that that's where that action is. I think it tends to break down. I don't think that oral history is very good with specific dates. I don't think it's very good with national trends. That is, things outside of a region. And I, you know, if you ask somebody, well, about westward expansion or the coming of the railroad, things like that, I don't think people really remember that. I think the more local, the more good the information is. I don't think that oral history is very good on economics. You know, finding out, what was a poor year, what was a rich year? How much did you make, or what was going on? I think the more personal, the more immediate, and the more geographically localized, the more valuable the information source. Any thoughts, any additions on that? You agree with me completely?
Yeah, here it's only got. It's before that, you know, it's like,
what I'm thinking about is economics is things like, when did the price of fuel oil begin its massive jump?
Okay, this is just recent. Before that, the economics used to be on if you're a good hunter or not,
mm-hmm.
or if you're a good provider or not. Within maybe 30, 40 years ago, maybe even less than that, the better hunter you are, the better provider you are, you were considered rich. You know, the cash flow before the cash,
mm-hmm.
before
mm-hmm.
that dollar came around.
So, it's the dynamics, it's the values, it's the standards of the people that are critical in terms of the oral account. It's not how much money do you need to buy the gas that you need to get the kicker going in 1930 or 1940, that comes out. What comes out is the dynamics between the people.
There's another thing that really is...
Although some people can tell you about, well, the price of gas then was 50 cents a gallon or whatever.
Economics around here, mostly in the oral tradition, would be whether there was a scarcity of game in a particular time, you know. And that's really important to understanding the history of the region and the way people migrated from one area to another. That, you know, you hear constantly, well, things, hunting was no good down there, so we moved our village. We had two or three bad years, the caribou didn't come through, so we moved to another spot, or people got sick and died. And that's really the economic history up here until 1900, was, you know, where the game was.
And usually what they do is they move to, like, they had a base winter camp, they had a spring camp, they had a summer camp, and they had a fall camp. And when I was growing up, that's exactly what we used to do. We used to stay in Kayana, base camp, springtime, we moved to near Tovik. Then after that, then we moved a little further up or above Kayana, School River, depends on, you know, where they want, or what they're gonna get for the summer. And the fall time, then we start getting closer to Kayana.
Mm-hmm.
And once they figure out, just like they start seeing icicles on the side of the river, then it's time to go home.
Yeah. I think that's very important, and those trends are very important. Don't lose track, though, of the fact that come the 1920s and the 1930s, you are dealing with an economic system here that is one that you're participating in, but one that is operating from afar, and in fact it goes back much farther than that. And maybe we ought to pursue that a little bit in talking about trade goods and the economics of the fur trade and stuff. Things that you'll need to know about that conceptually were taking place in the capitals thousands of miles away, but were directly influencing hunters here. Those type of economic variables do not come out very well in the oral history record, but are important for you to know about in terms of understanding what's going on locally. It may be used elsewhere, and I think it's important for them to...
Wait, okay, yeah. Do we...
The 28th?
29.
This is Bill Schneider from the Rasmussen Library at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. And I'm here at the Northwest Arctic School District doing a little program on oral history, a joint program of the Nana Museum and the Northwest Arctic School District on January 29th. And we're going to talk a little bit this morning about steps to a good oral history and what I call the art, science, and responsibilities of oral history. So let's start with the steps. You know, when we look at the steps to a good oral history, we often think that once we've got the tapes in our hand, that we've got it all. And that all we need to do really is, once we've got the tapes, is to toss them in a shoebox and forget about it. When in fact, the tapes are only one small part of this whole process. Once you've got the tapes, you've got all these other steps here that need to be done in order to get it in an ideal form, in a workable form for people to use down the line, and in an accurate form so that you can go back and check what someone says and not just rely on what you think they may have said. And each of those is critical. Let's start at the top, and I hope that all of you will chime in with your comments and criticisms and suggestions as we go along. The first thing is to determine the project goals. What do you want the project to do? What does the community want the project to do? What do the people that you're going to interview want? And this takes a great deal of time to think out the project goals. And you shouldn't rush this process because it's going to take time to get people to talk back and forth and to build upon past experience. It's important to review the existing sources of information once you've determined what you're after. And some of the sources of information that you might want to use in building up your background on a particular subject matter include a wide range of things. We've talked about some of them. Other oral accounts, art, music, dances. What were some of the others that we mentioned?
Maps, photographs,
newspapers, archaeological evidence. Putting that together, using those as sources of review so that you're somewhat prepared to go out and actually ask questions of the people you're going to work with is critical. Now, it's also important to remember that you may not be able to get all the information you want from those key resources.